Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most Fridays we take on the week. Today we take on a year, 2008, a giant of highs and lows from politics and the economy to oil prices and the Olympics. For the first time in American history, an African-American was elected president. Barack Obama called it on election night.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
The economy melted down, home foreclosures, layoffs, a $700 billion bailout, and a cry for help from many, including Detroit's Big Three. Here's GM CEO Rick Wagner.
We're here today because we made mistakes, which we're learning from, because some forces beyond our control have pushed us to the brink, and most importantly, because saving General Motors and all this company represents is a job worth doing.
And then there were the games. American Olympian Michael Phelps won his seventh gold in Beijing by a mere 100th of a second. The very next day, he had to swim the third leg in a medley relay. It was up to his teammate to seal the deal for eight.
And Lisa, the hero in the 400 free relay, won't let Phelps down at all. History in Beijing for Michael Phelps.
This hour on Point, our Friday news roundtable looks back on an extraordinary year in the headlines. We've got a great crew, and to help us look back and wrap up 08, with me in the studio, Jonathan Kaufman is here, senior political editor for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us for much of the long campaign season and was with us at Denver's Mile High Stadium in August for Barack Obama's convention acceptance speech. Jonathan, thanks for being here to wrap up the year.
Thank you, Tom.
With us from Washington, we're joined by Barbara Slavin with her great eye on world news. She covers world and national security for the Washington Times, author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Barbara, great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Here we go to the end of the year, sir.
Hello, Tom, Jonathan, and Barbara.
It is hard to know where to begin with this year. Let's just get Hank Paulson on tape here on September 22nd as everything was melting down. Here he is on the 22nd of September, Treasury Secretary Paulson urging senators to pass the $700 billion bailout plan. He admitted what he was asking for was not an attractive option.
I share the outrage that people have. It's embarrassing to look at this, and I think it's embarrassing for the United States of America. There's a lot of blame to go around.
Embarrassing and painful. You look back to the beginning of this year, Jonathan, the good times were still pretty much rolling. The Dow was down from its high of the previous fall, but things were still big. We hadn't had Bear Stearns. We hadn't had Lehman Brothers. We had nothing like what we're looking at right now. In strictly economic terms, Barack Obama and everybody else are going to have to deal with this. Maybe it's the envelope for us all. I mean, the only milestone people can look back to at this point is the Great Depression, it seems, for some point of comparison.
No, I think it's true. I think, you know, when we look back at the year and you think of that great moment on election night where Obama stood before 100,000 people in Chicago, sort of symbolizing the hope and the change in America, you have to wonder, looking back, whether we're going to see that as the high point of his administration, where everything goes downhill after that because of all the economic woes, or if, in fact, he is able to pull a Roosevelt and get us through this. But, you know, I think economists are disagreeing about how serious this is. Will there just be a bad recession? Will there be a very bad recession? Mm-hmm. Or are we in for 10 years of pain? And I think when we look back, you know, 2008 will be some kind of a breakpoint. And if we're lucky, we'll get out of it in a year or 2 years. Mm-hmm. But if not, this could turn out to be a very bad start for a decade-long problem.
Barbara, you sit in this country with the rest of us, but look carefully out at the rest of the world. When you look at the way Americans are perceiving what's happening with their economy, and you look at economies around the world, the global economy, is everyone equally freaked out there? Are there highs and lows of concern about what's going on geographically?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think when all of this started, there was a fair amount of gloating in foreign countries. The thought was that this would somehow be contained in the United States or maybe just in the Western countries, and that Asia, more authoritarian countries, would somehow get away with it and not have a great impact. But of course, now that that gloating has turned to dismay when everyone realizes that all the boats are sinking at once, and so we're really seeing a lot of problems. Some countries are a little bit more protected than others, but in China, of course, toy factories are closing because this was a bad Christmas. Banks are having problems in Russia. You're seeing a run on the ruble like you haven't seen for a decade. Basically, the only countries perhaps that are not hugely affected are those that are so poor that they're not really connected to the international economy. I guess it's been good for pirates.
Good for pirates, and maybe nobody else. Jack Beatty, so here we sit looking forward at maybe a year or two or 10 of tough times in front of us. When you look back at 2008 in strictly economic terms, Jack, they affect everything else. They intersect with everything else. How do you see this year?
Well, somebody remarked that it took the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression to elect the first African-American president. And there's no doubt that that ensured the election of Obama. I think he was going to win regardless, or a Democrat was going to win. But that may be the only silver lining in this story. You know, during the Depression, John Maynard Keynes referred to the problem as a magneto problem, just a problem with ignition. We had to get the economy started. The economy, the industrial economy, then was fundamentally sound. That's not true today. This crisis takes place against the backdrop of the long-term relative economic decline of the United States economy. We were at 50% of world industrial production in 1945. We're at 20% now, and the crisis in Detroit is symbol of that decline in our real economy. And, of course, the whole middle-class life that was supported by that high industrial preeminence is now at risk. And beyond the current crisis, which I think can be set right by a magneto ignition, there is this long-term secular trend that we'll all be living with, I think, for a long time to come.
Barack Obama speaking straight to that on election night in Chicago's Grant Park at his victory, but also in August at Mile High Stadium in Denver. We were there, Jonathan. Everybody heard it, accepting his party's nomination, Barack Obama looking to rally American voters here for change.
Tonight I say to the people of America, to Democrats and Republicans and independents across this great land, enough! This moment, this election is our chance to keep, in the 21st century, the American promise alive.
And there's the question itself. Barack Obama in August in Denver with 70, 80,000 people. And then election night, here's a voter in Atlanta talking about the historic moment of Obama's ultimate election with tears of joy.
It wasn't stolen this time. Every vote counted. Everybody turned. The numbers couldn't lie. There was no way to deny us. This time, we got it. This is our America. This is it. Oh.
This is it, she said. And you hear the emotion right there, and it was echoed right across the country. Let's get our listeners in here right away. Janet in Dubuque, Iowa. Janet, you're on the air. We're looking at 2008. What's going to stick in your mind, Janet?
Well, I am a political junkie, and I used to live in Iowa, and then I was living in Wilmington, North Carolina for 20 years. And the night that sticks in my mind is when I heard the caucus results for the Democratic Party in Iowa, and Obama won that. And I was so thrilled. I was so appreciative of Iowa to do that, and I was thrilled for the United States, and that was my most thrilling moment.
Thrilled because you thought it would never happen, because
yes.
It was, and there it was.
Yes, it was. And I'm a white person. So I was thrilled.
Janet, thanks very much for calling. Jonathan, it's been a huge year on the economy and anticipation of different economic policy, but the racial factor never far from anyone's mind in this political year.
Well, I think what's so interesting is, you know, you see the impact Obama has had on African Americans. That's obvious in the emotion of that voter we heard. But I think it's also had a tremendous impact on whites as well. I think everyone in the country feels proud of what's happened. And I think the ripple effects of Obama's victory will be with us for a long time. I was just on college campuses recently doing some stories, and all the professors are saying that black students are walking differently on these college campuses. They're more confident. They're all applying to better schools. They're suddenly suddenly thinking, hey, you know, this is something I could do because Obama did it. And I think among white students, too, you see this sense of, you know, we showed that we could rise to this occasion. What I think is so interesting, though, is that at the beginning of the year and really until September, so much of the conversation was about race and the impact of race. Since Obama was elected, we've heard very little about that. And it will be very emotional on Inauguration Day, and we'll continue to hear about it. But I think it shows, in a way, the same way everyone worried about John F. Kennedy being a Catholic, suddenly he became president and no one talked about that anymore. You have to wonder that right now Obama is being measured as a leader. Can he solve the economy? Who is he appointing? How will he deal with foreign policy? Suddenly people are treating him like the president, not as the first African-American president. And I think that's an interesting switch that I think has come very quickly because of this crisis.
Absolutely. And just one of the many, many big tumblers rolling in history this year, 2008. Jonathan Kaufman with The Wall Street Journal, Barbara Slavin at The Washington Times. Jack Beattie, please stand by. We're looking at an incredible year in the news, 2008. Behind me right now, Bo Diddley died at 79. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Well, so long, mama. Baby, bye, bye, you bye. Well, now, bye, bye, baby, with those tears in your eyes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an incredible year in the news, 2008, with election, Obama, economic meltdown, oil to the moon and back, Mumbai attacks, Beijing Olympics, Madoff, Spitzer, and so much more. Barbara Slavin is with us from The Washington Times. Jonathan Kaufman from The Wall Street Journal. Our own Jack Beattie is here. Eartha Kitt, the latest in a long line of those who died this year. On Christmas Day, 81 years old. On television, she was the sexy Catwoman on the Batman series. Always remembered for her perfect rendition of Santa's Baby behind us right there. She's gone, along with a lot of others. Let's get a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. And Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask two questions. One, what does this meltdown say about the capitalist system? Now, our present administration has thrown a lot of money at the very, very rich, and they've made the rich richer. The rich have immediately grabbed bonuses and given themselves parties, and I'm glad for them. But the rest of us are out of work and face bleak times. Now, Reagan said that the only thing that was wrong with government was government itself. Is that true? Can we get out of this by giving more money to the very, very rich to see that they are richer? Or is there maybe some other way to deal with this?
Tom,
what does it say about capitalism?
Yeah, your question is, I think, a mark of exactly how much everybody sees on the table at the end of this year, 08. Barbara, I mean, think about it right around the world. Capitalism itself, big questions now, in most cases, not whether or not to drop it, but certainly whether or not to modify it, to change it. And Western and Eastern models of capitalism in competition here. China's already got a lot of government intervention. Japan always has. The United States now looking forward to maybe having more of that itself.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic. I think, though, that the flaws in all of these systems have been made apparent. I was reading an article from Iran the other day where the former head of the central bank was complaining about the way the government had intervened and overstimulated the economy and what that had done to the banking system in Iran. So, you know, this is a much more authoritarian system, much more state-controlled, and yet they're facing some of the problems that the United States is facing because of overstimulation of the economy. Of course, it happened here differently. Here it was a lack of regulation. In Iran, it was because the government forced the banks to loan money at interest rates that were below the rate of inflation to the poor, to try to help the poor. It's a little like they made a comparison with the subprime mortgage crisis, which was kind of interesting in a way.
Jack, I'm sorry, Barbara.
No, in both cases, very bad results economically.
Jack, we haven't seen questions of this scale at the center of the national conversation in decades, and there they are in 2008.
There they are, and not only in our conversation. A French banker was quoted over the weekend in the Financial News, the Financial Times, comparing this year to the financial crisis to the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. That symbolized the end of communism. And many people think that this crisis symbolizes the end of a certain kind of capitalism, a capitalism pushed by an ideology, really, of low, just as our caller Tom said, of government is the problem, complete laissez-faire, let markets do what they want, an ideology pushed with conviction, really, by Reagan and with expediency by Bill Clinton, with its own an ideology with its propagated by institutions like the American Enterprise Institute and believed in utterly and romantically almost by the maestro of our current crisis, Alan Greenspan. And that ideology may be played out, and played out not because some other economists argued against it or because some left-winger said it was unfair, but because it was disproved. It was shown that you can't trust this casino economy to produce prosperity for the masses. In fact, it can be inimical to social health unless it is regulated and regulated heavily.
And we will hear plenty of debate about exactly that. Jonathan, you're at the Wall Street Journal covering politics right up against all that coverage of the news. How do you see the political and economic abutting this year, 08?
What I think is so interesting is that when you talk to the Obama administration, the people who he's speaking to, his advisors, no one really has an answer. That's part of what I think these questions are so profound. It's not as if the people around Obama are coming in saying, this is our plan. They have a short-term plan. They have a stimulus plan. But there is no – you get the sense talking to them that we're going to try different things, but no one even knows the full scope of the problem. There's a lot of concern. There's going to be a credit card crisis coming up, that there'll be still even more foreclosures, that Detroit is just, you know, the first of a series of bailouts. And so what I think is so troubling in a way is that no one seems to have their arms around exactly even how to deal with it. You know, the Reagan administration came in 1980 and said, we have a plan. This is our analysis. Mm. Government's mm-hmm. the problem. Mm-hmm. This is what we're going to do.
Take it away. Let the markets rip.
Exactly. You know, Democrats have had the same attitude periodically. Now I think everyone, Republicans and Democrats, are sitting down saying, we've never quite seen something like this. We know some mistakes we don't want to make, but there is this tsunami coming towards us, and we're not quite sure how to stop it.
But the politicians are still only part of the equation. The business community is sitting out there as well. What about in that realm? Are people, yes, it was very good times for those at the top, but it's ended very, very badly, even for those who had a lot of money invested, Madoff right on down.
Right.
Are they thinking, gee whiz, maybe indeed we do need to regulate this differently or not?
Well, I think they're at least accepting that there is going to be more regulation. Whether they agree with it or not, they know that it's coming. And I think perhaps sort of like the drunk who wants his liquor supply cut off, they realize that they need some people to tell them no and to control things. So I think everyone understands that. But I think the real question is, you know, can Timothy Gartner and others in Washington make better decisions than, you know, Jamie Dimon and Sandy Weiss and others made over the past 10 years? Are we just assuming that Larry Summers is going to be smarter than Warren Buffett? And I think that's part of the debate that's going to be going on, is trying to muddle through this and find a way to come out of it. But I think certainly in a political sense, business understands now that they are in a defensive crouch. I think people may make a lot of money. They're not going to spend it in the same way. You won't have that conspicuous consumption. Like you saw the Detroit auto executives, the first time they flew on their private jets, the second time they drove their Priuses. You're going to see a lot of Prius driving among the wealthy corporate class in the next few years.
Let's get a call from Virgins, Vermont. And Eben, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think one of the most interesting things this year is how diametrically opposed the DNC and the RNC were with regard to just the corralling of support, both for positive and negative ways. At the RNC, the arrest of journalism or journalists there, and Amy Goodman's arrest just for their coverage and their presence there.
The arrest of journalists and a lot of protesters in the streets outside the Republican convention in St. Paul. Yeah.
Exactly. And also, the follow-up to that is that the relative lack of coverage of their arrest surprised me. I listen to your show virtually every day, and I was expecting a lot more coverage of that. I think that as a fellow journalist, this would have been there would have been a lot more discussion about this. I think it's such a subtle – it was made a subtle thing, but it's to me it's so counter to what our culture believes the freedoms that we have. It's I found it just very profound and very slight coverage of it.
There were definitely very different moods at those two conventions. And in this year of such big events, I think a lot of tension over where the focus should be. Is it on what's in the streets? Is it on the policies that are coming out with which the country is going to ultimately address these problems? Jack, I mean, you've been watching this dialogue and we're paying close attention to the tone out of these conventions.
Yeah, Evan's comment reminds me of 2004 when the convention was in Boston, and in order to get in it, you had to go by this formidable security apparatus and buy a big pen, a sort of pen, where protesters could protest, where speech could happen, but it could only happen in this confined space. And some clever person on the walkway had scrolled down the First Amendment to the Constitution, so we were walking on it in order to get into the convention. And, of course, it showed what terrorism, the you know, it hinted really at the dark side of the war on terror, which is the limitation, sometimes symbolic, sometimes real, on domestic speech and also on domestic privacy, of course, with the illegal wiretapping. So it's a reminder, I think, of the domestic effects of the war on terror.
Jonathan, you were covering these conventions closely as well.
Well, I think, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that a lot of conservatives believe that, in fact, the story about the press in this election was how much in the tank we all allegedly were for Obama. And there have been lots of studies done looking at the coverage of Obama versus the coverage of McCain, the coverage of Palin. And I think the conservatives certainly feel, and many Republicans feel, that they were running as much against the news media as they were against Obama. And one of the things, you know, when you talk about the economy and folks in the doldrums, the growth industry and the people who are really excited right now are Rush Limbaugh and Mike Huckabee and conservative talk radio, who really feel that there is an atmosphere out there and an appetite for different kinds of news and for coverage of issues in a very different way. So I think while, you know, things certainly happened that many liberals and a liberal journalists were upset with, I think another big storyline here when we talk about trying to bridge the partisan divide was an increasing sense among conservatives that they were locked out of the mainstream press and didn't have access, and that one of the reasons that McCain lost so badly, they feel, was that their issues didn't get covered as well as they should have been.
Barbara, how about the Obama, the American news, the American economic news, and their play globally? We saw a lot of positive response to the Obama election. On the other hand, you know, we all see what's happened with the U.S. economy unspooling in front of the world's eyes. What about the American standing, reputation that we've heard so much about this year, 08?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Obama election has had an impact. How big it is, you know, we'll have to see. How long a honeymoon he gets, we'll have to see. But clearly, people around the world were astonished that he got the nomination, let alone that he actually won the election. And I've been to a number of Muslim countries recently. I visited a number in March, and there was a lot of skepticism about whether he could ever emerge to become president of the United States. So there is going to be a good impact. He's spoken about giving a speech in a major Muslim country. He's going to use his full name, Barack Hussein Obama, when he takes the oath of office on January the 20th, and that has a lot of symbolic importance as well, particularly for Muslim nations. But yeah, I mean, the economy, it is the economy. You know, what he does on that front, I mean, every single person around the world that has any connection with the international economy is praying that he will somehow bring this terrible period to an end, that Americans will start spending again and buying products from the rest of the world. So people around the world definitely are going to be hanging on his every word and his every action connected to the economy.
Let's get a call from Mike in Buffalo, New York. Mike, you're on the air.
How are you? This has been a unique year for me, especially. It's the year I discovered Tom Ashbrook on the radio. It's been an amazing year from that.
Oh, great.
I want to mention, as a McCain supporter, and I know this is a cliche comment, and I'm sure Jack will have a comment to say, Sarah Palin, the way she was treated by the media so harshly, so much bias, not a chance, a woman who became from PTA to governor, what positive elements that were never focused on. I think it's a shame for the country and a shame for her and the political process.
Mike, let us pick it straight up, and thanks for calling. Thank you very much, Mike. As we do that, let's listen to John McCain introducing the Alaska governor. This is September 4th at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. McCain joined his running mate and her family and asked the crowd a question that many say ended up costing him dearly.
Don't you think we made the right choice for the next vice president of the United States?
Mike in Buffalo doesn't think she was treated right. Well, here's one interview, September 25th. Interview with CBS's Katie Couric, sitting down with candidate Sarah Palin. She was defending her statement that Alaska's proximity to Russia enhanced her foreign policy credentials.
We have trade missions back and forth. We do. It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America. Where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border.
Jack Beatty, easy to mock. Putin rears his head and that sort of Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade balloon comes into American airspace. But there's Mike in Buffalo saying, come on, she didn't get treated right. What did you see ultimately in the treatment of Sarah Palin?
Well, I remember when she was first announced, it was on a Friday morning, and I didn't know anything about her except that she, the lineaments, her outside story, governor, reform governor, throughout the Republican establishment. And I remember feeling and saying, this is a very hopeful development. With this, McCain has gone on the historical bandwagon. We're going to have either the first African-American president or the first woman vice president.
Mm-hmm.
But then it became clear to me, and I think to others, that she simply was not prepared to be on the presidential stage. And that's just a statement of fact. I know Mike thinks it's unfair, but it wasn't the press. It wasn't people like me saying she's not prepared. It was herself. It was interviews such as that one with Katie Couric, where it was just plain that while she could be an excellent governor of Alaska, perhaps, she simply was not ready, had not schooled herself, was not familiar with even the outline of the idiom of national politics and policy, that she had no business being there. And I don't think that was the press. I think that was her. And then there were all the ethical problems that came out. You know, I mean, she began with a lie when she said, I'm the one that cut the bridge from nowhere to nowhere. And, of course, that was so much more complicated and on and on. So I understand he feels that way, but I really think she did it to herself.
Jonathan, how about Sarah Palin and the Republicans more broadly in this year, 2008?
Well, I think, it'll be interesting when we look back. I mean, in a way, this has been a remarkable year for women. It's been overshadowed in some ways by Obama's victory.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, we had Hillary Clinton coming very close mm-hmm. to winning the nomination. She's now Secretary of State. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, probably the third most powerful person in Washington right now.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Palin did break through a glass ceiling for the Republicans. I don't think anybody would be surprised to see a Republican or a Democratic woman governor run for office as president or vice president in the future. So I think she did shatter the glass ceiling. The other thing that has been shattered, though, is the Republican Party. And one of the things that the Republicans have to deal with now is their own internal war between the true conservatives like Sarah Palin. Whatever you think of her credentials, she clearly stirred up the base. I saw her speak. She got much bigger crowds than McCain. She got fervent support out there among a lot of base Republicans. And then you have the more reformist wing of the party, say the Schwarzenegger wing, the mm-hmm. Tim Pawlenty, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to see throughout the next year these two wings battling each other, trying to figure out, as the Democrats have in decades past, what they stand for and how to take on the Democrats in future elections.
We'll go out of this segment with Miriam Makeba of South Africa, dead this year at 76. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about 2008, an incredible year in the news with election, Obama, economic meltdown, oil to the moon and back, Mumbai attacks, Beijing Olympics, Madoff, Elliot Spitzer. Some big goodbyes this year. Bobby Fischer, Arthur C. Clarke, Sid Charisse, William F. Buckley, George Carlin, Studs Terkel, all gone. Sundays will never be the same. Meet the Press moderator Tim Rossert, died of a heart attack. He was 58.
Our issues this Sunday: former Bush Press Secretary Scott McClellan rocks Washington and rattles the White House.
Actor and activist Paul Newman lost his battle with cancer. Here he is in The Sting, Best Picture, 1973.
Don't hand me into that crap. When you come to a game like this, you bring your money. How do I know you won't take a powder?
No.
And folk singer and civil rights activist Odetta, dead at 77. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Jonathan Kaufman, senior editor of the Wall Street Journal, is here. Barbara Slavin of the Washington Times. Jack Beatty's here. We have Norberto calling right now from Sandusky, Ohio. Norberto, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. A World War II hero and a personal hero, my father died 2 weeks before the election, and he predicted that Obama would win. And our family is of mixed racial identity. I told people, don't worry, but still go out to vote. Now, a lot of people still had doubt. I was kind of impressed by the amount of doubt that people had. And one other thing, I'm a photographer. On the election day, I photographed a group of high school students, and I walked up to them and I told them, you are the future. There were about 16 of them of all different creeds and origins and races. They look so beautiful. And I sent it into a couple of magazines. Maybe it'll get published. So those are my impressions.
An image to stick in your mind. Sorry for your father's death, Norberto. And Jack Beatty, that doubt to the very end that such a thing could actually happen in this country.
I saw an interview with John Lewis last night. He said, quote, I never, ever thought I'd live to see this. And of course, he suffered in the civil rights movement. He bore a crease from a policeman's baton on his skull. So it seemed inconceivable to him, as to many Americans, that this could happen. And, you know, I to get back to something Jonathan was touching on, how this election has changed us and will change us. One thing it's changed is our idea of ourselves, of what we are as a people. And I think no policy failure, no political failure really is going to efface that. And as Barbara says, the world's idea of us has changed too. Race has been the incubus in our history, and which isn't to say we've gone over on the race issue, but my God, think of what 8 years, or 4 years at least, of seeing Barack Obama leading the country every day, seeing his lucidity, his intelligence, just the things that you are struck with every time you see him. That's going to work away at the substratum of American race feeling, and all to the good.
Let's get a call from Montreal, Canada, and Gil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, how are you?
Very well.
One of the things that resonated with me this year, being an American living abroad, particularly in Montreal, where we're listening to Vermont Public Radio, is the fact that this year feels like the U.S. has finally rejoined the Community of Nations. And that, in my mind, has two facets. One, the fact that Obama was elected, and I like the idea of that it increases the pride finally in being American, especially abroad, and the feeling that Obama is going to sort of re-engage the United States with the rest of the international community. And the other point is that given the financial meltdown, I think that has really killed, at least for the moment, the idea of laissez-faire capitalism, which in fact, particularly on issues like the environment, is going to allow the United States, in my mind, to be able to agree on less laissez-faire policies and more interventionist regulatory policies to tackle the climate warming problem.
Gil, let us pick that up. Both Barbara Slavin, the U.S. rejoining the Community of Nations, I wonder how that sounds to you, if it looks that way to the rest of the world. And also, I can't help but think, with the Beijing Olympics in mind and that awesome display of at the very least, extravaganza power and spending by China and organization, you know, the U.S. is not the only big power on the stage anymore, and it's not the one with the fullest coffers. Are there open arms for the U.S. back into that community, and what about its relative standing vis-a-vis others, Barbara?
It's an interesting comment. I think we have to give credit to the Bush administration for beginning that process, really, in the last couple of years after the reaction to the Iraq invasion and so on. We saw under Condi Rice, as Secretary of State, more of an emphasis on diplomacy, and I think we're definitely going to see that in the months ahead. We're going to see a reinvigorated U.S. involvement in the Middle East peace process, diplomacy with Iran most likely, definitely a different approach toward climate change. And one indication also that the rest of the world is going to embrace this. There's been talk among the Europeans of taking some of the detainees from Guantanamo. You know, Obama has said he will close Guantanamo. This is a huge symbol to others of our betraying of our own goals, ideals, traditions.
So and in a way, this is a helping hand from Europe?
Yeah, we're going to see a helping hand. We're also going to see the Obama administration asking for other countries to step up in Afghanistan, Europeans to send more troops. So it's going to be more of a two-way street, perhaps, than we've seen under the Bush administration. On China, I mean, this has been an extraordinary year for the Chinese in terms of highs and lows. You know, they had a horrible earthquake in Sichuan province that killed more than 60,000 people.
Yes.
Shoddy schools collapsed. This is a country
where
many families...
5 million homeless there.
Yeah, many families have only one child because of government policy, and that one child was killed because these schools were not made with reinforced concrete. You've seen a lot of protests, even more labor protests, as factories have closed because of our recession, which has become their, if not recession, it's cut their growth rates from double digit down to 8, 6, 7%, which is not good for them, not sustainable for them. So you have that, and then on the other hand, you have the amazing spectacle of the Olympics, which, of course, we saw a lot of engineering. Remember, they had a little girl who was lip-syncing because they felt that the girl who was supposed to sing the song was not pretty enough. Mm. So I think we've seen the good, bad, the ugly from China this year. We've seen a lot of contradictions. And while this country has tremendous power, financial power and reserves going forward, it's in for a lot of challenges as well.
Jonathan, you were Wall Street Journal's bureau chief in Beijing for years. Here we see the tragedy of the earthquake, the glory of the Olympics, and then at this year's end, as exports dry up, real pain in the Chinese economy, thousands of factories closing. How do you look out and assess China at this point?
Well, I think, you know, you were asking what will we tell our grandchildren about 2008, and I think one of the things we may end up telling our grandchildren is, gee, it was a Friday night, and I was watching TV, and we watched these opening ceremonies, and looking back, that's the moment I realized that China had arrived. I think there was a sense in living rooms across the country when they saw those opening ceremonies
that,
gee, maybe
spectacle.
There's a country that can do things better than we can. I think it was the first time that Americans, you know, we're used to thinking about China as making toys and masses of people and all that. But the idea that they could technologically do something and put on an extravaganza like that, really in a way that we couldn't. And Michael Phelps won his 8 medals, but the Chinese won 51 gold medals.
But, of course, North Korea can do stadiums full of amazing flashing cards. Yeah. We did see those schools fall down in Sichuan. We do see factories closing down, not to take away from China, but it's not all muscularity.
No, absolutely.
There.
And I think like the United States with its underclass and its crumbling roads, I mean, countries are made up of bundles of contradictions. Mm-hmm. But I do think the thrust here is that China is on the rise. It will have huge problems. But I think any notion that somehow China will be crippled by these problems, I mean, for example, in 1989, the last great year that we talked about, there was a lot of talk about Germany becoming resurgent, a unified Germany being astride Europe. And that really hasn't happened in a sense. Germany has not reestablished itself or tried to be a world power. China is and will. There will be hiccups along the way. There will be problems the way the U.S. has economic problems, the way Russia has economic problems. But I think what we have seen now is that certainly in the perception of China, China has turned a corner and broken into the world consciousness, that this may not be the Chinese century, but it will be a much more of a multipolar century with China as one of the forces to be reckoned with.
Can I add something there, Tom?
Mm-hmm, yeah, yes. Just China is about to send a ship to the waters off Somalia to help in the fight against piracy. And this is the first time that a Chinese naval vessel will be outside the Pacific and home waters. This is
and the
quite
first armada out since like the 15th century.
Yeah,
I think,
you know, that even as much as the Olympic ceremonies, a lot of which were faked, which were digitally faked for our TV screens, I think this aspect perhaps is even more significant. And also China's enormous reserves, all the treasury bonds and bills that they own. They've just had a $500 million stimulus package of their own, and they're probably going to have more. And I would imagine they're looking for buying opportunities among our failed companies.
Let's get a call from Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. I, like a lot of people, have hope, but I find myself still troubled by a few aspects of this last year and what's going to come up in the next year. Mm-hmm. I'm still troubled by Barack Obama having voted for Pfizer. His choice of Rick Warren, I just cannot reconcile myself with. In particular,
this is for the invocation at the inauguration next month.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. How bad a choice could you possibly make? I mean, to say that that was misstep would be putting it mildly. But on top of that, I'm also disturbed by my fellow voters. When torture came out, the news of it came out, I didn't see any popular uprising and outrage. When Pfizer and the fact that we were being spied on, I didn't see Americans saying, wait a minute, what's our government doing? I want to see revelation in the coming year. I want a complete disclosure about what this country did in the last 8 years. I want the names of the people who were involved in torture. I want us to say, wait a minute, is this what we did and why did we do it? Short of that, I don't see complete redemption.
But you may end up getting exactly those things, though. You and the country will also have Rick Warren for the invocation, the closing prayer, another matter at the inauguration. Bill, let us pick those up if we may. Jack, let me come first to you on Rick Warren. I mean, here you have an evangelical preacher, but of a different stripe than the Falwell era, let's say. Barack Obama, a rather deliberate man, reaching out to him to do the invocation. Do you see betrayal there, or is this exactly the kind of different politics, new amalgamism that Obama promised? How do you see it?
Well, it certainly can be packaged that way, but just speaking for myself, I'm offended. The things this man has said about our gay brothers and sisters and friends are appalling. And if he had said it about any other group in the country, African Americans, Jewish, Catholic, he wouldn't even be considered. And I think it says something about the stigma that still attaches to homosexuality after all these years, that this can even be thought of, that a man who has said the things he said, the really ignorant and bigoted things he said about gay Americans.
But Jonathan, on the other hand, if you want to go to that wing of the American community, and it is not small, and reach out, he's also said a lot of things that are much more in the vein of Obama's view of the world than many of his predecessors in that room.
Right. I mean, Rick Warren is not Jerry Falwell. He's not a hater. And while I think a lot of people have problems with his comments about homosexuality and other issues, he really represents, I think, an effort by parts of the evangelical movement, which has always been much more complicated. I mean, those of us who have written about it always come back from these places, you know, sort of shaking our heads saying it doesn't fit the sort of fire-breathing stereotypes that you get from watching mm-hmm. TV evangelists. Folks are much more complicated. And Obama both politically is reaching out, but I think also as a national leader understands that he wants to try to make this part of the dialogue, part of the conversation, lower the temperature. But what I think the reaction to Warren also suggests, and this could be perhaps a stealth issue from 2008, mm-hmm. as Jack pointed out, you know, if we haven't solved the race problem, we've certainly made great strides. If we haven't solved the women problem, we've made great strides. Gay rights kind of came up very late with Proposition 8 in mm-hmm. California mm-hmm. and has really created among a lot of people, I think, a surprising amount of anger at the defeat of that proposition for gay marriage in California. And I wonder if, as we always are, we'll be surprised by one thing in 2009, and one might be the rise of gay rights as an issue that really begins to affect politics and people's views of Obama and other elections. This could be something that we look back and see, gee, it broke late in November, but ended up having a lot of impact in the future.
And surely we're not finished hearing about FISA and torture and the rest as this administration wraps up. Mary in Cedar Falls, Iowa. You're on the air, Mary.
Yes, hello. I wanted to talk about the natural disasters that struck Iowa this year. I know 2008 will be remembered for the record flood.
Yes, indeed.
The flooding in our town surpassed previous record floods by 6 feet, not 6 inches, 6 feet. Mm. And of course, our friends to the south of us in Cedar Rapids, their downtown area was nearly wiped out. It was just unbelievable devastation in Cedar Rapids. And
do you see a global climate message in that, Mary? Do you see?
This is exactly my point. I think that this possibly might bring the conversation of people in our area around to the fact that maybe climate change is happening. It looks like this year we may be on our way to record flooding again. We already have more snowfall than we've had in any previous December. It's and the climate experts are thing. It's going to be a very wet spring.
Mary, let us hope it's not flooding, but our time is short. Barbara Slavin, Iowa felt it firsthand, not the only place this year in the world. Do you see something new congealing on this front around change in environmental policy, or is it just too daunting?
Well, one problem is how environmental concerns are going to mesh with concerns about the recession and whether somehow, you know, we just had a story in our paper the other day how in Australia, the prime minister there who ran on an environmental platform actually has come up with very low targets, only 5% reduction in carbon emissions by the year 2020. And the reason is the coal industry in that country is very powerful, and also the recession. They're worried about the global recession. So, you know, there are going to be conflicts, and we'll see how they're resolved. Also, I would say to the people in the Midwest who've suffered through these terrible floods, at least they didn't go through what Myanmar did. They had a cyclone, Nargis, that killed more than 20,000 people in May. So we're seeing catastrophic weather events, flooding, cyclones, typhoons, tsunamis, whatever you want to call them, and also record droughts in a lot of places as well.
Climate heads up in an amazing year. Isaac Hayes is our last out today, dead this year at 65. Shaft from way back when. Wow, what a 12-month stretch. I'm so grateful to each of you for looking back on it with us. Barbara Slavin with The Washington Times, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Kaufman with The Wall Street Journal, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty will be looking ahead soon. Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year, Jack.
And to you and all our listeners, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Jack.